Nicole Brandon, and welcome to Unlimited Life. We have such a special show for you today as we talk about how to lead an unlimited life, how to cross through those boundaries, those borders, those walls, those barriers, and be able to turn everything into a gate. So it doesn't matter how insurmountable the issues are that are in front of you, how simply you can just pause for a moment, even if the hinges are rusted, and get to the other side. And over the past few years, I've brought you the very top experts from around the world with the top techniques and tools and keys and secrets of really how to lead an unlimited life, unlimited finances, romance, business, success, relationships, whatever that means, to launch you into really living the life of your dreams. And so many of you have called in through the years and have found yourselves on deep, dark paths, or just absolutely stuck or in quicksand and not knowing how to get to the other side. And many of you have just been treading water, and others have been leading these incredible lives and looking for the more. Well, today's guest has taken the roller coaster of life. Today we are talking with the incredible, heroic, brave, and very special, gifted Laurie Burns. And Laurie really has led a life going from darkness to light, and now she has launched these amazing programs to help others find their way as well. So we are excited, we are thrilled, we are honored, we are privileged to be speaking with today's guest on how to lead an unlimited life, Laurie Burns. Laurie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Oh, it's such a thrill to be speaking with you. And for audience, we have the most incredible listeners to the show, because this show really is about how do you lead this unlimited life. And I remember reading a book once, and I think I was sharing this with you, and there's a little boy in the book, and he starts laughing from the airplane, and he says, "Don't you think it's funny they put lines between states? There are no lines between states." And I always love that, the separation of how we get to the other side. What is the other side? And for those that are new to you and to your work, I would love to talk to you about both sides of that coin, the life that you led that has brought you to today's work, and then this incredible work that you're helping people today cross over to the other side as well.
That sounds great. So you just tell me where to start.
I would love to go back to your childhood, because I think that a lot of times we talk to people about their childhoods and their lives. And we had on the Los Angeles fire chief on the show, and I asked him, did you know you wanted to be, you know, in the fire department? He said, "Not at all. I wanted to be an astronaut. I just,
wow."
He said, "But I wanted to ride the truck." And I love that answer. And so did you know when you were a little girl that you would be one who would be helping others on this path?
Oh, my God. You know, anyone who's read my book knows that my childhood hero, I mean, you'd think most people would be, you know, Mother Teresa. My childhood hero was Carrie, the girl at the prom. You know what I mean? Carrie, the movie.
Yeah.
And my aspiration was to be a hippie. So there was no way I was having any thoughts of being anything big in life. I wanted revenge, I think, as a young child. That's
and
why
I mean,
inspired by Carrie's power. It was the only way I could think I'm going to get any powers if I drew it out of the occult or something.
That's incredible. And for those of you that are in other countries that are listening from Malta or South Africa or France, wherever you are, Carrie was a very popular movie when we were growing up. And it was terrifying. This teenage girl could wreak havoc and terror in the most malicious, vicious ways, and at the same time that your heart broke for her.
Right. I mean, Carrie got back at everyone that hurt her. She was an innocent child that was bullied, which is big now, you know, the whole bullying thing, and she just got back at them. And they did a remake of Kimberly Pierce, just remade Carrie, so there's actually a new one out there.
Wow. And so tell me a little bit about your childhood, because I know it was not lollipops and roses and sunshine
right.
and parades. And I think that a lot of the people
right.
that listen to this show are very much in the same boat that you are. Their
right.
childhood was not divine, but boy, they sure would love to lead a very happy adult life.
Right. So I grew up in what looked like a normal home. I mean, we had nice things. My father was an airline, he was a flight engineer, the guy that sits next to the co-pilot in the cockpit, but he was on travel every couple of days. But we had nice things, and we lived in a nice neighborhood called The Estates. I grew up Jewish, so I went to Hebrew school, and we grew up in the North. I took viola lessons, I took singing lessons, so everything was normal on the outside, but behind the closed doors, it was a living hell. My father was physically abusive on me, and to a level that no kid should have to endure. And I was suicidal from the get-go. I truly thought as a child, God must hate me for something I did in a past life, like maybe I was a witch or something, because I could not reconcile why, if there was a God, he would have put me here. So I must have done something really bad to him. So from my frame of reference, God hated me and my dad hated me, and that's where we were starting.
I have a question for you that I've mm-hmm. never asked any guest, I guess, because you've authored this incredible book, Punished for Purpose. And
right.
Did you journal as a child? Did you write out your rage, your anger, or your fear?
Oh, well, journaling and writing it out, I guess, are two different things in my mind, right? Because journaling, you would think, is a positive outlet. But actually, I would write cuss words towards my dad and God, because I thought maybe if I could upset God enough, he'll just let me die. So I was very suicidal. I was cutting my wrists, throwing myself down flights of stairs. I mean, I'm sure it looked like I was the crazy kid, because nobody on the outside of our family could figure out what the heck is going on with this kid. But I would write really angry stuff, and that's about it, if you want to call that journaling.
Wow. And did you tell anybody, any teachers or
neighbors
or relatives?
No, so actually, because of what was going on in the house, and that everyone else was playing it off like nothing was going on, and of course there was maybe some possible sexual abuse going on with one of my sisters, and nobody's acting like anything's going on. I'm acting up. They're taking me to see psychologists. They were putting me on meds a lot. I was on a medication for schizophrenia for a couple of years. Once a year, they would put wires in my brain. I think it's called an EEG to see what's the matter with my brain. So what was happening in our house was Lori's acting crazy. We don't know why we're going to do this, you know, because better for people outside of the house to think it's Lori and not something's wrong with our family. So what I got as a kid from that message is, if you tell anybody what's going on in your house, they're going to think it's crazy. So I didn't trust the people inside of the house. So why was I going to trust the people outside? So actually what happened was, when I was 13, right after my bat mitzvah, my mom had left us alone with my dad, and things started to escalate. I look a lot like my mom. So his anger on me got worse. And one day I had a friend at the house, and he didn't realize I had someone there, and a beating erupted. And that would be the first time anyone would ever see what occurs in our house. And the little girl, again, we were 13, called her parents and said, "You have to come over here and get us. Lori's being hurt." And the parents took me over to their house, and they talked to us. They talked to me about what was going on. I did not say anything. I was very conflicted. And as a matter of fact, if you asked me, like, how did you feel that someone finally found out, I felt embarrassed and dirty. I felt crazy. I felt like something's wrong with our family. So I was embarrassed, and I didn't talk much. And I think when they got on the phone with my dad and realized I was suicidal, I've been to see psychiatrists, I'm stealing, I'm hitchhiking, I mean, it was crazy. I would do anything for power and control in my life. So I was getting into a lot of bad behaviors. I think these parents just thought this is much too much for us to get into. I was returned to my dad, and my dad, I think, was probably thinking, oh, how the heck am I going to deal with this now that people know? And he hid his handgun, called the police, and told them that I had it and I was going to kill him. So the police show up unexpectedly. I don't know why the police are there, and they take me to a ward for the criminally insane. And I was tied to a bed in a straitjacket and drugged. And I got to tell you, on the heels of my bat mitzvah, it was way too much to reconcile for anyone that's not Jewish. A bat mitzvah is supposed to be a time of, uniting with God. And right now, it was, for me, it was like, if there is a God, it is clear that you hate me. Like, if there was any questioning about this, now that I'm in this mental asylum, tied to a bed in a straitjacket, it's clear. I've got the message. And for the next 10 years, or colossal downfall into my own private hell.
Wow. And where was your mother during all of this?
Well, my mom had left New York and she came to California. So, yeah, she was calling back to the house and they would say I was outside playing for months. I really, truly did not know how long I was in that insane asylum until I recently got my records from when I was in People magazine. They had me pull all my records. And it must have been, you know, months that she had been calling before she started interrogating people in the area and found out from a doctor that a kid went to this insane asylum and she got me out. She didn't have enough money to get me to where she was. She was just a young woman trying to get her life together, didn't have any money. So I went to a group home in Stony Brook, New York, and that's where I met other people like me for the first time in my life, other little children that had been abandoned and abused. And for the first time in my life, I would bond to another human being. I mean, have a real bonding, like I belong here. Like these are my family. It's these little kids that are just so strong, that have been through so much. Like, I don't know if you've ever, you know, met a kid that's been through something and tells you what they've been through that's that young. It's just so heartbreaking. And at the same time, they were like my heroes, you know?
Now it's so incredible.
Yeah, and these kids were just like me. They were running the streets, but you know, they were kids that I looked up to, but eventually I came out to California, got into trouble. Before I knew it, I was in the system. I was a system kid. So I went through group homes, juvenile hall, running the streets, and by the age of 16, I started shooting up. Someone offered me a needle and some drugs at school, and I thought this is good because I was suicidal, and I thought it might kill me. And then by the time I was 18, I was addicted to drugs, had a daughter, and exited foster care to homelessness and started working the streets as a prostitute. And my mom came and took away my daughter, which was a good thing because she wasn't safe with me out there. And that was the beginning of the end for me, which was years of working the streets as a prostitute.
Right. To think about a child that has gone through such a journey that everybody thinks everything's okay, that even when there are people that learn that you're being abused to not want to get involved. I mean, how?
Oh my God,
it hurts just to hear.
I know.
That people would think, oh, that's too much for us to deal with.
I hope the 70s were so much different. People say to me all the time, Lori, why is this such a problem? And some of the ladies that I recently, women's group said, why do they put these kids in bad foster homes? And I said, well, there's 90,000 kids in foster care in California alone, and how many foster parents do you know? And most people say one, if one. Usually they say none. And do you know why? Because they think the kids are bad. Now, I live in a house with foster kids. I have, you know, for God only knows how long, and they are the best living kids. I don't know where that comes from, you know? They're so grateful and so inspired to do the right thing, you know, when someone gives them a chance. So, as you know, I was on the streets as a prostitute. I was 23 years old, and I was broken. I remember a few days before my life was saved, a man pulled a knife on me, and he wanted to obviously do bad things to me. And I just stared and said, go. You want to hurt me? You know how many times I've been hurt? I mean, go. Hurt me. And that man was just like, I could see my soul in that man's eyes. He didn't want to touch me because I was not protecting myself at all. I was like, you want it? Take it. And he left. He left. He was so scared of who I'd become, he left. And it was a couple days later, I was standing on Fifth and Harbor where I worked the streets here in Orange County. It's an area known for prostitutes. And I got in the back of a white car, and there were two men in the front. And they got on the freeway, and I knew at this point in my life getting on the freeway is bad. I saw the driver's eyes in the rearview mirror, and he looked crazy, like he was trying to get somewhere. And I looked around me, like I was very disconnected from life for years, but I could tell by the amount of cars that was traffic hour. And I thought, oh, my God, Lori, you cannot go through this again. I've been through so many horrific situations. So I jumped out of the back seat and into the front to try and grab the steering wheel to make them crash into another car so I could get out of this situation. And the guy on the right side, the passenger side, saw me coming and knocked me in the head with his fist really quick, and I blacked out for the rest of the drive, and I ended up in a clearing in the woods, and it was nighttime, and they got out of the front seat and into the back, and the driver had a gun, and I guess a girl on the streets had killed one of their friends in their gang neighborhood, and she was a prostitute, so their plan was take a prostitute from the street, kill her in the woods, and make peace with your friend's death. And I was that girl, and they got in the back seat, and after hours of being raped and beaten and having that freaking gun to my head, I realized, oh, my God, Lori, this is it. This is the moment you've been waiting for your whole life. Just get them to kill you. Just make it all go away. So I started screaming, kill me, like as loud as I could so that I could scare them and we could just end it. And I scared them, but now that I think back, I think they got scared someone was going to hear my screams because I was just top of my lungs. And they left me for dead on the side of the canyon road. And the next thing I know, there's big shoes, like there's someone tugging at me, and there's a van with like exhaust pouring out of the back. And I wake up to this big, huge, like man trying to pick me up. And I look down and I had just a shirt, a ripped shirt, and a lot of blood. And I looked at his van, and it was white seat covers on the inside, and immediately it triggered my brain, you're going to get beat again. So I started panicking, and I started pushing away from the guy and going, no, I'm okay, please leave me here. And imagine I'm on a dark canyon road in the middle of the night, but I don't want to go with this guy. And he picked me up to his eyes, and he had tears rolling down his face, and he said, please, would you please just let me help you? Just let me help you. And I think in that moment, like a flashback of my entire life, all the people that had tried to help me, I realized that God had sent angels my whole life to help me. I just never trusted anyone. Like there was a lady that used to visit me in juvenile hall, and there was a man that used to visit me to play checkers, and there was a man in the group home named Carl that used to take me to the bay. But I always had this no. I don't need your help. I'm okay. If you help me, I owe you. And I don't know where I got that, but I figured I don't want to owe anyone, so I'm not going to do it. But this particular day, I was beat down enough to let this man help me. So,
wow, Lori.
And to imagine what this man, I'm sorry, as I interrupt
for just a second as you share this story, when you talk about this man has tears in his eyes saying, please let me help you, imagine from his perspective seeing you.
Oh, my God. I can't imagine that. I only hope that one day he sees me on the news or something and he contacts me so I can hug him. He'll never know how impactful that moment was in my life because that was the changing point for everything. One person having enough hope to bridge me over from the hell that I was living into the rest of my life. And then, as you know, for the listeners that don't know, he delivered me to the hospital, and I went back to the streets, and the next day I called a man, another angel of mine. He was a kid that was abused when he was 14. He left home. They used to make him, his family, mom, dad, and sister would eat at the table, and he would eat on the floor with a dog. And he left at 14, never returned, joined the Marines, and he was leading his battalion, and he got shot with shrapnel, and he was paraplegic. And this man used to come and look for me on the streets, and somehow through saving me, I think he was going to save both of us from what was our past. And I called him, and I said, I need help. And he said, I will take you wherever you want to go. So he picked me up, and he took me to a sober living, and the rest was history. I mean, and that man, just enough, just a peanut of hope, maybe not for himself, but maybe enough for me. And that little speck of hope that you could have for another person that you think has nothing, maybe the very speck they need, that if they don't have their own hope, they can rely on your hope to bridge them over, you know? So, and feel free to bust in anytime because I know
because I want people to understand. You know, when you're saying that there were angels that came along the way and that you didn't trust enough to trust. And I think that in all of our lives, it's such a great lesson. One, how important it is to try whether people respond or not. To offer help, to offer care, to offer your heart, to offer your soul.
Yeah. You're right. Because you know what? Even the people that thought I wasn't listening to their lessons, people that told me things, you'll find out later that I listened to all of it. So if you're working with someone in whatever field you work in, trying to help people, and sometimes you get a little down because you feel like it's not helping, it's helping. Sometimes you just get to plant the seed, and other times you get to see the flower grow. But there were a lot of seed planters for me. They all built up over time.
When you say that, I always think about, you know, newborn babies learning how to speak. And you say, mama, dada, eyes, ears, nose, mouth, mama, dad. And the baby goes, gah.
Yeah.
And you just keep repeating it, you know. And then all of a sudden, one day, the baby goes, mama, day, whatever it is. And then they don't shut up. It's like once they make the connect. But as long as you're feeding that love, that information, that people kept trying to offer you, you're like you're saying, this man, a peanut of light, that I've never heard it so eloquent, and it's so simple, and it's so powerful.
Yeah, so powerful. So I get delivered to this sober living place, and I start to talk about my secrets. They say you're only as sick as your secrets, and truthfully, these secrets, like, I knew my dad hid the gun because my aunt revealed it to me. I never told on my dad because I wanted him to love me. But I started talking about it, and I started releasing myself from that. And I started, you know, the man that saved my life, the man that was a paraplegic, was very into computers. And when I got sober, he bought me a computer, but I lived upstairs after a while. I was in an apartment, and I got my daughter back, and we were doing well. And he bought me this computer, but I had things breaking on it, like the video card went bad. And he couldn't get up the stairs, so he walked me over the phone how to take apart my computer. And this, like, was the springboard for a career in computers. I got a grant for a small school. I went to this little computer school, and then I started reading and testing on all kinds of things. And it fueled a career I eventually was a program manager at one of the biggest aerospace companies in the world. And no one knew about my past until it exploded to People magazine. But by that time, I had been there so long. I think I'd already been there 10 years, you know. And parallel to my opportunity, and I just want to say that little teeny grant that I got, like, was all I needed to get started. And before that, when I was working the streets, I just didn't have anything. Nobody offered me anything. And then when I got sober, parallel to everything going on in my career, these abused kids started showing up in my life. And I tried, you know, seriously, I was babysitting a young girl who was 12, and her mom never came back. Her mom ended up dying. And I applied to be a foster mom, and because I had this little girl. My daughter was 9, she was 12. And they looked at my record and they said, absolutely not. You prostitute, stolen goods, I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff. This is not what we do with, you know, this is not a foster mom person. But they said, if you get 7 years clean and sober, sometimes we can apply for a waiver. So by the time 7 years came around, I had taken in so many kids, they were like foster moms. And that's when my life exploded. So my amazing life is just crazy. I actually have had 31 children. I have 3 kids that live in my house today. I have a new young boy coming on Monday. I have 10 grandsons, 1 granddaughter, and an amazing, amazing life. You know, and people say to me all the time, Lori, you do such great things. You're an angel. And seriously, that doesn't resonate with me at all. I'm not an angel. I met my family when I was 12 in a group home, those beautiful young children that had been abused, and I bonded with them. And now I'm bonded with anybody who's been abused, right? So when they call me with a kid, and that's what the social workers do, they'll call me, they'll say, I see you have a bed open, let me tell you about a kid. That's all I have to hear. You know, the minute they start telling me, you know, most people would say, okay, if they're saying this kid shot up, this kid's been a prostitute, this kid's a cutter, most people would back away, unfortunately. When I hear that, I'm like, oh, my God, when can I get this kid? Because I know, like, I have walked the path out, and I know the path out. And because of that, you know, when I was a kid and I used to think God hated me for something I did in a past life, I know now that he loved me so much. Like, how could I not see this? He gave me the exact path that I needed to walk through everything they've been through and walk out to the other side. So now I can hold the hands of the kids that are in the darkness and I can walk with them out. it's every day of my life that has been so beautiful now that I see what it's given me, now that I see that I have the ability to take others and heal them because of what I went through. So I always say, if you're listening and you're going through something, obviously probably not something that I went through, like this horrific story I just told you, but anything, you know, cancer of someone in the family, a death of someone in the family, I think if we go through things and we constantly stare at ourselves and say, why is this happening to me? We've lost the point. I think we go through things so we can be there to help so many others that will travel that path. Because the power in that, the power in having made it through that, you are just astounded. Well, you know, anybody that's been through anything now starts a charity for the thing they've been through when they get to the other side. But if you only sit there and think about yourself, then you'll miss the point of everything that you could have created for the people that have gone through the same thing. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I as you talk about these kids started to show up, and that mm-hmm. they didn't think that, you know, with your background that you would be able to foster children. And so I would like to, as kids show up, and for anyone who's interested in fostering, and I think that, you know, people now listening to this, how can you not be interested in fostering? And what's the first thing you say or do? How do you make someone feel safe?
You know, it's funny because it's always different, especially, you know, the little boy that's moving in on Monday. It's different with a boy. I have, you know, 31 girls, and my son, who died in February, was my only son, and I took Mikey in, my baby, when he was 11, and he died when he was 22, which has just been a rough year. But I think with every kid that comes, it's like a different conversation. So some kids get here, and we start talking, and immediately they're open. And, you know, it's almost like an interview, I guess you would say, when you first meet a kid. And I tell them, you know, at my house, you're going to be living like a normal kid, which is really a big relief, because so many foster kids have so many rules, you know. You can only eat during this time, you can only do this, you can only do that. It's a normal house. I try and get new sheets for the bed before they come in, so there's not, you know, when you're in a hotel or you're staying at a friend's house, there's always a smell, and it's not, and I'm not saying a bad smell, I'm just saying everyone has their own kind of aroma, even if it's a, you know, like a perfume smell. You want to start everything fresh, so it's you. So, you know, it's all you. It's all yours. That's so important. And just to let them know they can be themselves. I have one little girl that stayed in her room for the longest, like, isolating. And it was okay. And she wore all black with, like, a black hoodie on. And we had I had about four or five girls in the house at that time. And we all did not bring attention to the fact that she was spending a lot of time in her room or that she always wears black, and we just loved her up. And one day she walked out, her hair was freshly washed, her hood was down, and she was wearing a pink sweatshirt. And we were all in shock, but we did not let it show. But we knew for her that was the breakthrough, you know. So just to let the kid be where the kid is and to love them up where they are is everything, to not try and force them to do it the way you think is best done. So,
and do the kids get along, you know, when you bring in multiple
kids? Beautifully. Let me tell you, okay, so I'm going to, do you mind if I go on to the rest of the story?
No,
and then you'll
no,
see how
please.
Many kids there are.
Yes.
My kids love each other and are all so diverse in every way, diverse in religion, diverse in their beliefs, diverse in their lifestyles, but they love each other. Just like kind of like I did when I was a young kid. And I think it's because we talk so much about what happened. But like, I don't know, about 7 years ago, let me tell you, when people call me an angel, especially my sponsor who was like a mentor to me, I'm always like, I think God saved my life on that canyon road for a reason. Like, that was the turning point in my life. And she was like, Lori, you've got like 30 freaking kids. Of course. You know what I mean? That's the reason. And I'm like, no, there's something else. And like 7 years ago, I started waking up at 3:00 in the morning every night. I thought it was my sprinklers, like that sprinkle my lawn. But I looked and they go off at bam. So I'm like, no, it's not my sprinklers. What the heck? And I started talking about it at these meetings that I go to where I, you know, stay sober. I have like a sober group. And one of the men in one of the meetings is an American Indian. He said, the spirits talk the loudest at 3 a.m. Any American Indian could tell you that. That's part of our core belief. So I started Googling it, and true to the word he said, there are a ton of books on waking up at 3 in the morning. So I had this little God box, I call it. It was a prayer box. When things were driving me nuts, I would write it down, throw it in the box. One of my kids made me this box in Woodshop, my daughter Chelsea. So I started writing notes. And, I started writing notes. You know, funny thing, when I first got sober, I had this problem with God that I thought he was punishing me. And the ladies told me I could believe in anything a God as long as it wasn't me, because none of us were really religious. So I had seen a movie about God when I was a little girl, so I actually prayed to George Burns. So I've been praying to George Burns for several years, and if anyone needs a spare God, he works well, okay? So I started writing notes to George, like, what the heck is going on? And all of a sudden, I started getting invited to all these strange things and showing up to everything to try and find out why my life was saved. And I got recommended by the county supervisor to serve on the foster care advisory board, which only has a handful of foster people there. And I thought they must have completely lost my file at this point. I knew they gave me a waiver, you know, for my past. But being on the board, I think it was because I was taking the worst kids, you know. Any kid they couldn't place, they'd call me with that kid. And what I found out is kids are leaving foster care all over the country on their 18th birthday. And 65% were going homeless. That was in 2007. 65% of 25,000 abused kids that we had taken in. I mean, when you think of those numbers, are you kidding? 65% of them are going homeless? And if you think of the stats, it's one thing. But think of a little kid that was abused and then taken out of their house by county officials, and they said, it's going to be okay. We're going to protect you from the abuser. You're going to a new family, and then you're in the new family, and while their kids are planning on going to college and doing proms and things like that, and the other kids at school, you're planning to be dumped. And they're going to leave you on the street with no money, no car, no cell phone. And sometimes, if you're lucky, they'll drive you straight from court to your homeless shelter. And this was devastating to me. I was, oh my God, I could not believe this is happening in America. And still today, I believe it's like one of the biggest secrets, but Google the word emancipation. Nicole, if you Google emancipation and see how long, since 1989, this has been happening, 50% of kids from foster care today, this is 7 years later, will still go homeless within 18 months. And I couldn't believe it. Now, I had met some people, and this is what I'm talking about, planting the seeds, that said things to me. One man said, Lori, Martin Luther King talked in such a way that he could transmit his vision to the hearts and the minds of the people in such a way that they could see his vision in their mind and they could feel it penetrating their hearts, even though it didn't exist. And if you could talk in that kind of a way, people will listen to you and they will follow you. Now, this is at a totally different part of my life, but I remembered it. Another man said to me, Lori, if you take a bunch of fleas, like bugs, the little jumpy bugs that bite, and you put these fleas in a jar and you screw the cap on, if the jar is like 4 inches and they jump up and hit their head a couple times, they'll start to jump 3 inches for fear of hitting their head. And even if you let the fleas out of the jar, they'll always jump 3 inches for fear of hitting their head. And Lori, you are living your life like you're still in the jar, because what happened to you was so many years ago, and I see you holding yourself back when everything's available to you. You can jump big. Lori, jump big. And I remember hearing him say that, and I was so happy to be alive and to have my daughter back and to have these beautiful kids that I think people believed in me at sometimes more than I could believe in myself. And that was what that man was referring to me. Like, he saw something in me that I didn't clearly see. And then the last one was an elderly woman that was, I guess you would call her psyche, like Jewish religion, we call it sodic, like she could see into other worlds. And she was with me, and she looked down like she was thinking. And then she looked up at me and she said, Lori, one day you're going to be a little girl swinging on a swing. And the next day you're going to be an old lady. Make sure
you do in this lifetime, what you are here to do before it ends, because your life is going to go by like that. And then she snapped real loud. And now standing here, Nicole, at 51, I got to tell you, she was so right. And I feel the pressure, right? So I got out there after I learned about what was happening to the kids and started talking about it. And within a month, I had like $400 in little donations from people like you. I mean, just regular people are like, oh, my God, you've got to do something. Here's $10. Here's $20. And I started a charity on LegalZoom. And within 10 months, I had $180,000 in the little bank account. And I was like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? And I had these, like, 30 people following me. My best friend, Linda, was helping me. And Linda was like a real estate agent. She said, let's buy a little house. And let's take some homeless girls and put them in the house and let's get them through college, whatever we have to do. So we bought this 3-bedroom house, and I wasn't happy with it. I believe where you live reflects on how you feel about yourself, and it was kind of like a broken down old house, but we bought it anyway because we knew we had to get them in shelter. And a bunch of the men that were following us that were in construction said, this is not good enough. We're going to knock it down, keep a couple walls up. We're going to knock it down, and we're going to build up a brand new house. And each kid will get their own room. They built up a 6-bedroom house with wood floors, a beautiful, beautiful house. And we took 5 girls off the street. Designers came in and they decorated each room. Like there's a Marilyn Monroe room. There's a green room. They decorated each room differently. We took 5 homeless girls off the street and we said, what do you want to be? And Chelsea wanted to be a fashion designer. She had been carrying this little article from Fitim since she was like 14 years old. And we got Chelsea into Fitim. I remember the day we were sitting there and she was tears rolling down her face. And Janelle wanted to be a doctor because she got hit by a car when she was 6 crossing the street alone. And no one came to the hospital to sign consent. And she got placed in foster care. So Janelle just got accepted to Loma Linda University where she'll complete her course to be a doctor. I know.
That's incredible, Lori.
Amazing young women that were homeless and didn't have a chance. And then we started a street outreach. We're like, oh, my God, there's thousands of kids everywhere. And then we started a street outreach. And then one of the guys that worked on my team at Northrop Grumman said, you know what, I can probably on the weekend start to scrape all the shelters around the United States and build a database so we could do like a hotels.com and kids all over the country can search online, and we'll push it out to Facebook and MySpace at the time. We did that, and then I'm like, you know what, Matthew? Homeless kids have cell phones. Homeless kids today, you know, Nicole, everybody's connected. You see kids with devices everywhere. Homeless kids would rather have a cell phone than a sandwich. Like an old person would rather eat, homeless kid would rather connect. So they're in the libraries at free internet access, but a lot of them have cell phones, like day-by-day cell phones. So we pushed it out to the cell phone. So now any youth in the nation could text the word shelter and their zip code to our short code, and it will respond to a shelter. It will respond with a text saying where the shelter is closest to them within 40 seconds. Unbelievable. And, you know, when he did that, this is a young, brilliant guy, like a Zuckerberg-type guy that worked at Northrop, and he just happened to be on my team. He said, you know, it'll take $15,000, and it'll probably take me 3 weeks to build it. I didn't have $15,000. The very next day, I got an envelope in the mail, and it said, I forgot to support you last year, and I want to support you this next year. So here's $10,000 for last year, and here's $10,000 for this year. I hope you do something good with it. And that was the Harry J. Brown Foundation. They launched, this lady had no idea when she sent that donation. They launched what has been a solution for kids all over America since that day. Amazing,
so all they
amazing
do is they
stuff.
Text the word shelter, and it tells them the nearest shelter?
Well, you have to put your zip code in because that's how it runs the algorithm, right? So you do shelter 90210 to 99,000, and 99,000 is a number. It's a phone number. It's called a short code. And within 40 seconds, you get something in Beverly Hills that's close to you. So that's what
incredible.
We do, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Lord, then, what a gift.
You'd think it would have stopped there, but God really had big plans for me. Every time I think he's, okay, this is it. No, that's not it. So someone said to me, well, you've got to bring this thing to Los Angeles. We've got homeless kids all over the place. And, you know, I live in Orange County, and I drive to Los Angeles to go to work at Northrop. And but I thought, you know what? If God wants it, it'll be. So I went to Venice Beach, and I was standing in this place. It was a charity that feeds homeless kids twice a week and gives them clothing. And I was standing there when they opened the door, and hundreds of kids walk in with, like, if you could imagine, 18, 19, 20 years old with, like, wounds on their feet because their shoes are worn through from walking so much, with bugs in their hair and dreads in their hair, and some of them with babies. I'm like, oh, my God. I sat down with some kids, and I had dinner with them, and I said, where are you guys from? And they said, Foster Care. And I'm like, oh, my God, you guys are from Foster Care? I could not believe it, Nicole. It's devastating. And I thought, oh, my God, as much as these people are trying to help, who could take a little girl and feed her dinner and send her back to the street at 19? So I was, like, on fire in L.A., and all of a sudden I started getting donations from people in the Venice area and people in the greater L.A. area, and they gave me money. And some man had a big warehouse right off the sand, and he said, Lori, someone that meant a lot to me gave me this place, and I need to do something good with it. So he handed me the keys, and he said, build it, and they will come. And now we have hundreds of kids that come into our drop-in center in Venice Beach and tell us their stories, and we refer them to the 18,000 shelters. So that was, oh, my God, on fire. And then last year, right around this time, I was contacted by a man who comes from a very gifted family, and he finances movie films, and we're friends because he's heard my story. And he wanted to meet a movie star that I was friends with, another guy that heard my story. And together they would create this place called Free Rehab. And his idea was, this man had struggled with addiction. His idea was, I want to give people the thing that I had. And he explained to me, Lori, I come from one of the richest families in the country. And when I went through addiction, I could make a phone call and they would rescue me. I was on the street with people that didn't have a phone call to make. I want to be that phone call for them, and I want to open Freehab. So they hire me to find the movie star wanted a warehouse, and the other man wanted a old treatment center so he didn't have to put a bunch of money into conversion. I found a treatment center connected to a warehouse within, I want to say it was 3 weeks. Yeah. Because now God and the angels show up in my life. I truly believe somehow I've been connected to a bunch of angels. And I signed the lease on this place that's about $1.8 million. And the very beautiful man that had the idea in the beginning, who I'm so close with, had a medical tragedy, right, and could not engage. He gave me enough money so that I could get going for a little while. And the movie star backed out and never gave us anything. And I think it was just for him, it was like promotion or something, right? So I end up with this big, huge facility and just enough money to start it. And it's empty, and it's 100 beds. And I have signed a lease for $1.8 million, of which I have about $300,000. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I started a target list online. It's about Christmas time. It was this time last year. And I'm going to do the target list again this year, just so you know, for everyone that's there. And I said, I need to decorate 100 bedrooms. Can you guys add a pillow to your Christmas list or your Hanukkah list or a blanket or a towel for $2, just anything? I started getting hundreds of gifts in boxes, like UPS boxes. And then I put a note to all my friends on Facebook. Can you please decorate a room? I'll put your name on the door permanently. My only requirement is that you decorate it with love. And within 2 weekends, we decorated the whole 100-bed facility except for one little area, and Maroon 5 showed up in the final hour and said, we need to do something good, and they decorated that final area. And the whole place is absolutely beautiful. So here I have this beautifully decorated place and no money. Some man calls me after reading my book, Punished for Purpose, which is on Amazon, read my book, never met me, and said, Lori, I just finished your book, and I need to help you. And I said, how do you want to help me? And he said, I wish I knew. And I said, no, I think you know. I think everyone knows what the immediate thought is that comes to their head that they push away. And he said, you're right. I'm supposed to donate $500,000 to you for some reason. And I'm like, what?
Wow.
You're what? And he said, you will get a wire from me for $500,000. And I said, do you realize you have just opened the doors to a facility that will take homeless young girls that are being sold into trafficking all over LA and give them a safe place to live. And somehow I'm going to put them through school. So he makes this donation. And I got to tell you, I'm still like a million short, and it keeps me up every night. And I write grants all the time, and I'm like, it's still keeping me up, Nicole, because I have helped 152 young girls to get off the street in the past 6 months, get free drug rehab. You know, I applied to be a drug rehab. People told me it's going to take 6 months to a year, but landed on the desk of a man that helps group home kids. He called me and said, Lori, I'll have you done in a month. I just, one angel after another, Nicole, I can't explain it.
That's
so right
beautiful.
Now.
So,
yeah.
So for those that are listening,
yeah.
How can they help? You know, so you're a million short and you still need grants and you still need scholarships. And so where do they go and how can they help? And
right.
Tell us, because everybody, I know this is just, how can your heart not be open and drawn to this? This is
oh my God.
Good.
We need money so desperately right now. And, I know there are some people that can donate a little bit, and a lot of little bits add up, and there are other people that can donate a lot, and they don't even feel it. You know what I mean? But we can save so many lives. What happened was we have that empty warehouse, and we decided to create a school. So right now, if you call 1-888, not right now because I'm on the phone, but after this, if you call 1-888, the number 4, and the word teen, like teenager home, 1-888-14-HOME, I will pick up the phone and you can help us. If that doesn't work and you want to go online, go to theteenproject.com and there's a donate link. Or you can go to freehab.net and that's the new place. It all goes to the same place. So what I'm doing right now, Nicole, is I'm building a technical school on site. Most of the girls have not graduated high school. We're going to, much like Homeboy Industries, for anyone who knows them, they take gang members and they make tortilla chips. We're going to take these girls that were trafficked and we're going to teach them web development and web design. And we're going to start doing the most brilliant professional websites for the community. They're all going to be trained up in several areas of technology. And can I tell you one more miracle? I don't know how much time we have.
Yes, absolutely. We always have time for miracles.
I have this idea, like this is a very modern school that I'm going to build. It's going to cost about $900,000 to build it, which is a brilliant price for saving hundreds of thousands of lives that will come through there, because at the rate we're taking them, we'll take 300 a year. So I wanted to call it the Bite Shop, B-Y-T-E, because you get, there's a sandwich area and a coffee bar in my mind, and the rest of it's just this very retro, a lot of Macs and learning area. Right? Different areas, software, hardware, web development. And one of my guys on my team said, Lori, you can't get the Bite Shop. The Bite Shop was the original shop that built the first 50 apples for Steve Jobs. I mean, that's a pretty big name. And I had thought of it in my brain. And he said, I looked at it, the trademark was abandoned. So I'm like, really? So I look up the original guy that started the Bite Shop, Paul Terrell, worked with Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, and I located him in Florida on Tuesday. And I said, Paul, you have this place called the Bite Shop. And he said, oh, yeah, Lori, I built the first computers. And I'm like, I have this idea. And I told him, you know, about the kids that were being sold into trafficking, and we could transform their lives. And the lobby could be a museum to the original guys that had a dream, which was the two Steves and Paul. And he said, this is brilliant. Go ahead and use the name. So he sent me all kinds of beautiful documents from way back when and Time Magazine when they had a dream. And we're going to create the Bite Shop. All I need, my rabbi says, Lori, you've got all the money in the world. It's just not in your hand yet. So I need somehow for it to get to us. So if anyone's listening, need that you can donate to help. If we all put something in, maybe we can do this thing. And Nicole, this will be a life transformation, and I expect it to do so well that I want to prototype it throughout the U.S. This is my dream.
Well,
and
it
then,
is a brilliant
if I actually
dream.
Die, my
yeah.
life will have been worth living, you know? Yeah.
Absolutely. And when people, you know, want, I know that everybody's writing so diligently now, and you're sitting down and you're saying, okay, you know, 1-888 for, you know, Teen Hope, the Teen Project. .net and Freehab, and you can send a text. You can send a text message on your phone to 55678. The text is just 55678, and the message is simply Nicole. And you can download a copy of today's show, so you can hear it over and over again, and actually write down this information and everything that Laurie's sharing. These statistics on emancipation, this incredible story, how to get her book, Punish for Purpose. So just by texting 55678, the message is Nicole. You can get a copy on your iPad, your phone, on any mobile device for free, and listen to the show over and over again, because, Laurie, this is just incredible. And I know we only have a couple minutes left, but I would love to touch also on the event that you have coming up, I believe in just 1 week here in Los Angeles. And for those that are able to attend, I certainly want to open the door for that for people. So,
So if you go to freehab.net and you click on Red Carpet Event, you'd be able to buy a ticket right there. So next week on Saturday night, we're going to have a spectacular list of people performing, and I will be telling my entire life story at that event. And you'll get to meet the kids, and you'll get to stand in what is the future bite shop, and you'll get to walk through the facility and see all of the rooms with the names on the doors of the people that cared. I've got to tell you, Nicole, when you go into this place and you feel the vibe and you meet the kids that are just so happy to be there. For anyone that saw us on Fox News last night, we had a 30-minute special, and some of the girls talked on that segment. It is just life-changing. That fireman that walked through to approve our fire code were just, like, set back by what was happening there. I just would love for anyone that wants to get involved to please, please, please. I always say these foster kids have been forgotten about since 1989. Tomorrow, although we may feel inspired today, tomorrow our regular life hits and we start driving kids to school and we do all our regular stuff, and it kind of falls into the background. I'm just praying and hoping that we don't forget the foster kids today. That if you think tomorrow your life's going to hit so hard that you'll forget what happened today, please write it down. If you don't forget.
And then can people contribute grants and scholarships, and are there other ways that people can't make the event on Saturday that beyond the financial, that they can actually also contribute to be able to help these kids launch into the future in their life?
Yes, you can contribute scholarships. If you have a company and you want a kid for an internship, and we're close to Burbank, so if you're close to that area, you can offer those kind of scholarships. If you have a school, like we just had a dental school offer scholarships, a culinary school offer scholarships, I am the grant writer. If there's any grant that you know of for seed money to build out this school, please, please, please connect me with whoever that is. I need to do this thing. I'm literally not sleeping. I wake up every night going, how are you going to do this? One brilliant man said he would donate $50 for everybody who liked our page on the Teen Project. So if you go to the Teen Project Facebook page, or you go to the Teen at the Teen Project on Twitter and you follow us, this man will pay $50. So if you don't have any money, the very least you could do is follow us on Twitter at the Teen Project, follow us on Facebook, and that is the Teen Project as well. And this man will pay your $50. If you can help, and he said he will pay up to $100,000, Nicole. So if all of those people start doing that, he will pay us $100,000 next month to go towards the $900,000 that we need for the school. And anybody else that could help with the other $800,000, oh, my God, we need your help.
And as we're coming to the close of the show, the Teen Project, the name, you know, how did you come up with the Teen Project? Because there's so many things you do within that house and within the life.
Right. And you know what? I came up with the Teen Project because I didn't know what to call it. And I had all these people following me, like the Martin Luther King thing. And I kept on going, you know that Teen Project thing you're working on? You know the Teen Project thing we're doing? And that some guy from NBC, this wonderful man, Vic, that was working with us, said, Laurie, you've already named it. It's called the Teen Project. And Nicole, I forgot to mention one more thing, and that is as my story gets bigger and bigger and they start telling the stories of my kids, and it's been in the news and on People Magazine, my father, heard about what I was doing and tried to take his own life a couple of years ago. And I got the phone call from the place that had him in custody because the police had to take him down. And when I got on the phone with my father, and I had been writing notes to my father through therapy for many years because I realized maybe nobody ever loved my dad. Maybe that's why he was so abusive. And I loved my father up. I figured I would be the one to. Gandhi says, be the change you want to see in your world. And I was the change in my family. And my father called me, the doctor called me, and he had him in custody. He tried to kill himself. And my father got on the phone with me, and he said, how dare you? How dare you love me? How dare you forgive me after everything I've done for you? Done to you, I should say. And I said, Dad, do you realize it's because of every day of my life that I have this beautiful, amazing life? I love you so much. Every day of my life was perfect. You need to forgive yourself. And I found out my dad was a foster kid. And on that day, he was my oldest foster kid. And he is now one of my biggest followers. And he is so all over everything we're doing. My life is complete.
You are so remarkable. And I agree. You are an angel. And for all that you have been through, I mean, punished for purpose, your book, The Teen Project. Prehab, all of these kids that you are opening the door and the future to, your amazing, remarkable journey. You really teach us what it's like to lead an unlimited life,
unlimited love and heart and spirit
and soul and diligence and determination and unlimited giving and care and hope.
Thank you. And hopefully we teach a lot of young girls the same thing, and they are our future.
Absolutely. So the Teen Project, and we look forward to having you back, and even maybe to having some of the girls back. I would love to talk to them.
Oh, they would love that.
And
they would
share their journeys and stories. It would be wonderful to be able to follow up, because I really believe that this is something that we all should be part of, this really getting these kids onto the other side of living the life of their dreams. So thank you so much for letting me tell the story.
And
I wish you an amazing event. And for all of you, go if it's fly in, if it's possible. I mean, see the space, see the place, meet the
kids.
Send
a silent auction item.
Make a difference.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
We have a silent auction. Yeah, anything, everything, anything would help.
Well, thank you for being with us, and we wish you all the best. And
thank you,
truly,
Nicole.
What you are doing is so very, very, very special, and you are loved.
Thank you,
Laurie.
Okay.
Wow, what a beautiful guest. So go to the event November 15th, Los Angeles, the Teen Project, Prehab, donate, give, share, help these kids. Foster a child, gift a grant, gift a scholarship, gift your love, and like Lori, gift hope. This is Nicole Brandon and Lori Burns wishing you an unlimited life.